forget about that one. Going to Mars sounds like a great idea. Every one of the high school kids are dreaming about doing it. You've got to solve that huge problem of consumables. The International Space Station is getting a progress delivery every couple of months, and tons of stuff are being brought up as consumables. As I see it, the only way you could possibly do even interplanetary, the nearest possible planet to go there, you're going to have to recycle like no tomorrow. Just sit and think. Get yourself in a quiet room and think real solidly about taking every single molecule of fluid, solid, and gaseous materials that comes out of a human being for a year and recycling it thousands of times successfully. That's a steep problem. Huge problem. And when you're out there in space, 300 million miles from home, and you get on the radio and you holler, Mayday, hey, my food recycler, my water recycler, my solid waste recycler has broken down, I need some help, you ain't going to get help. You're half a year or three quarters of a year away. Live horse until you get water. So if that machinery breaks down, it's game over. And that machinery, nothing like that has ever been done. Yeah, we recycle paper and tin cans and whatever. We have never recycled every single molecule that comes out of a human being and make it back into convertible oxygen, food, and water. We've never done that. We dream about it. A few people have put pencil to paper, and they think they got a scheme for starting to do it. Very difficult problem. So that consumable problem, as I see it, and I never hear anyone mention that, to me, it's a huge problem. I hope I'm wrong. So, without a doubt, we've made some tremendous progress, technological speaking, in the last 100 years. In the next 100 years, we're going to make 5 times as much progress. And maybe some of these problems will be solved. But they're pretty stiff problems right now, as I see it. Some people get a little bit depressed that I'm, you know, throwing water on a real good idea of international space travel when I mention these kind of things. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to you, Frank. Sorry we didn't quite answer your question. I use it as a launching platform, but it's still an exciting question. WB2BXO, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Well, you basically told me my intuition was right on that. And I think if I really wanted to, I could do the math and figure out what frequency, you would come out on if you were transmitting a laser at a certain frequency going at something approaching the speed of light, what frequency you'd have to tune to on Earth to hear the thing. Assuming given the path loss and the energy loss due to redshift, which is something I didn't think of, by the way. That you can hear it at all. Any of us who want to do the calculation can figure out what frequency we would have to listen on if such a spacecraft were out there or to be sent out there. And that's interesting. But that implies something even more worse is that on their way back, where this signal is greatly blue shifted, the spacecraft would then have to somehow transmit a very narrow beam signal on a very low frequency, maybe something in the HF range or even lower, depending on how the math works out, for us to receive a signal in microwave or even approaching the visual light. And, that signal would obviously be much more diffuse and would probably be have to receive, now that I think about it, would probably have to be received out in space, down converted, and then, by a satellite, then relayed to Earth. It probably wouldn't be able to receive it down here at all if that was doable. But you're right, I'm sure that's just one of many, many problems that makes interstellar travel or even interplanetary travel, as you say, extremely challenging. Very interesting. Well, thanks a lot. It was fun to talk about. HRU was a lot of fun also today. I didn't get to go to the magnetic antenna forum. I was someplace else, so be interested in hearing what somebody has to say on that. Back to you, Dick, your B2BS.
I'm glad you mentioned Ham Radio University. Do give us a couple of sentences as to what lectures you went to and what was it like. What did you see, Frank, at HRU?
Saw a couple of people I haven't seen literally in 30 years, which was kind of nice. That was probably the highlight of it to me. And but also, let's see, what forums did I catch at least part of? Saw George and Diane talk about their most recent trip to Grenada to do a field day type operation for CQ Worldwide 2006 back in October, which I found quite interesting. Saw a workshop on contesting where I don't think it was George, where some of the guys talked about the latest contest software that they're using. Apparently some people now are shifting over to N1MM, free access-based software project, as opposed to WriteLog and CT and some of the other contest programs. And which other? There were a couple of other... So Frank Fallon gave a keynote speak and a speech, and of course touched on the changes in licensing and consequent changes of culture or possibly lack thereof in amateur radio, and things along those lines. Go ahead, Dick.
Very good. By the way, Ham Radio University is obviously among us radio people who live and breathe this stuff. We just can't get enough of it. We understand how it works. We don't fear it. We love it. We're not afraid of it. We like it. We just can't get enough of it. The general population is the opposite. There's approximately one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. Take a look at Thursday, January 4th, the front cover of Newsday. The article is entitled, Towers of Trouble, Fight Over Emergency Radios. Some Nassau policies, localities, block anti-terror plan. The Department of Homeland Security has dedicated multiple millions of dollars to Nassau in particular in order to upgrade the radio systems for intercommunicability between the services, to make improvements for fire, police, ambulance, and so on. From their point of view, the quality of the radio systems is definitely deficient. That's why they've dedicated multiple millions of dollars. A number of those towns are saying, no, you're not going to do that, not in my backyard. You're not going to put those radios in my backyard. You're going to give my kids cancer. That is xenophobia personified or Q multiplied, if you know what I mean. It is, these people are sincere. They think they're protecting their children. They think they're doing the right thing. They think they're using good common sense. And the word RF radiation is scaring the hell out of them. There were a couple of cell phone base stations and a fire and a police listening station on the water tower near the school in the town of Bayville on the North Shore. And the residents got wind of the fact that those antennas have been there since 1993. And they are fighting mad over that. They want them removed. Have a mistaken belief that they're protecting their children by eliminating radios. They're now in the talking stages of asking for all of the few antennas that are in the town, and there's one-tenth the number that should be there, and they want those eliminated and moved to some other town, not in my backyard. We all, within the sound of my voice, are really charged with the responsibility of trying to give some education here. Everybody cooks their food with a microwave oven. Radio waves do nothing but heat. There is no non-thermal effect. Extremely different compared to nuclear radiation, where the nuclear decay of a radioactive substance creates ultra-miniature little bullets that come out of there at the speed of light. When those bullets, those particles, of nuclear radiation due to the decay come out and strike your body, yes, they do some damage. And yes, they possibly can create a cancer. A radio wave is not a particle. It is a pure wave. It does nothing but heating. And so the amount of exposure we allow for ourselves with our radio transmitters is 1/1,000,000th of the amount that you get when you hold the cell phone against your head. And so if the town is really of the opinion that they should eliminate those antennas on the water tower that's near the school, then every one of those people should stop using their cell phone. They should stop using their wireless LAN on their computer. They should not let their children go into the sun, because sunlight is giving them an amount of thermal energy that's 1,000 times greater than the worst case scenario you can explain with the antennas that are on that tower near that school. And those antennas are saving people's lives, and they're needed for communication. So we are all charged with an educational problem. It's not unique to that town. Because a lot of towns on Long Island, according to this article, are now saying, I don't care how many millions of dollars Homeland Security is giving me, you're not going to put it in my town. And the few that are there, you're going to take them away. Or in one or two cases, they're saying, I don't want it on the water tower near the school. I want you to move it another 200 yards away. I want you to build a brand new tower. Well, the words roll off the tongue real easily. Build a brand new tower. And they think, well, Motorola or somebody else is going to build the tower. It's not going to cost us anything. Oh, really? Whenever a radio tower is put into a town, I don't care if it's a cell phone base station or a general communication tower, it costs close to $1 million. Each one of the people doing, each one of the organizations do that, set aside $250,000 just for legal fees. Let me drop a second. In other words, just to go to all the town meetings, hire all the experts, hire all the attorneys, just to get the approvals in the town, on average costs $250,000 just for that bureaucracy situation. And when you put up that tower for near $1 million, you think somebody else is paying for it? You're paying for it. No matter what service you buy from any of those organizations, you're paying more dollars. So nothing's free. There ain't no free lunch. It's foolish to think you've got to put it on another tower. It's foolish you think you've got to construct more towers simply because you're saving the children. It's a strong misunderstanding of radio and its xenophobia. And many of these communication systems for fire and police are maintained by a phone line. The receiving sites pick up the signal, put it on a phone line, and send it back to the police headquarters. That is equipment that the fire and police have no control over. And you have a community that has floods, the phone line goes out. That's part of the reason that New Orleans, Louisiana got in so much trouble with Hurricane Katrina. When the phone line went out and the police radio communication went down, the police no longer had the communication that gives them security, it gives them safety. They no longer could holler Mayday, officer being fired upon. And so they felt their life was at risk, and they abandoned the town. In some cases, they abandoned the state. They went AWOL. What little bit of communication was taking place during Hurricane Katrina was done by runners, because they were depending on the phone line for the backup. Foolish. Simply because they didn't want to, many of these towns on Long Island are afraid to put up a microwave dish, because microwave sounds twice as much like cancer than regular radio. 20 years ago, when we first started using microwave ovens, people used to make a joke, I'm going to nuke my food. And for a short period of time, people were afraid of the fact that the food heated with a microwave oven would have some kind of molecular change that wouldn't be healthy. Nowadays, almost every one of us, almost every day, is eating food that sometimes has been cooked in a microwave oven. So the microwave oven, which is hugely stronger, doing nothing but pure heating, it's okay for our food, but 1/1,000,000th that amount of energy, we're not going to allow our children to see it, even though it keeps people alive. You get the picture. It's foolish. We radio people, 1 per 500 in the population, really are charged with the responsibility of educating. This xenophobia we're talking about here is an education problem. But until that education takes place, the bureaucracy is going to slow down the normal deployment of radio communication that's being funded by the federal government. They're handing you the money, and we're saying, no, take it away. That is a lethal decision. People will die. It is depraved indifference. It's technological suicide. We're not in the 21st century. These opinions are maybe a little bit extreme, but I think you see where I'm going with this. Something that got me hot under the collar this week. Barry, I know you got some questions. You better hurry before I really get going. Into Moonbound. Hope you got some more rodeo.
PNJ.
Mr. PNJ recognized.
It was not a Newsday.
That was the Thursday, January 4th issue of Newsday, front cover. Towers of Trouble. Fight over emergency radios. Some NASA localities are blocking anti-terror plan. That's what's on the front cover. And it goes on for a couple of pages inside. If you know what you're reading, it's preposterous. It's lethal. It is, what's the word for it now? Technological homicide is what it literally is. People are going to die because of those decisions. They shouldn't have to die because of a misunderstanding and xenophobia. Barry, I know other people, Mr. PNJ, I think you wanted to say a couple of words. Go ahead, Tim.
When you mentioned towers, I remember the nightmare you went through 20-some-odd years ago with the town of Huntington with your tower.
Exactly. And the way that turned out was amazing. And face-to-face, I'll have to give you some more information on that. Barry, N2MB, I know you had some questions. K2RIW, you got it, Barry.
Okay, yeah, I can't say I have much more audio. I was looking to see how to turn it up, didn't find a way to do it yet. Anyhow, I made a little progress with the Foursquare antenna. And while I'm looking at what I'm doing, I have one of the antennas pretty much in place. It's not finished yet. I'm going to be starting on another one, I guess, in a week. My question is, and I know from talking to you in the past, you've always said that this is not a critical thing. You've told me, and I agree with you, that if you have elements on an antenna slightly above the boom or below the boom or slightly slanted or maybe not exactly in their space, not all that critical. Now, what I'm asking on this antenna is when I'm looking at it from the ground as I'm starting to construct it, I'm beginning to think that these antennas are not going to be, the apex, for instance, isn't going to be exactly 35 feet above the ground or 40 feet above the ground. One might be 40 feet, one might be 30 feet. Want to know how critical you think that is. The distance out from the tower may not be 45 feet, it may be 40 feet. You know, it's going to vary. I'm going to try to do the best I can, but I want to know how important this is. And also, considering these are all driven elements, how critical is their length? If I was a little off on resonance on one, is that going to make a big difference, considering that they are, in fact, electrically driven by the length of the coax? Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to take them in reverse order, Barry. When an antenna is higher or lower resonance, even though you're feeding it the signal at exactly the phase you want, the antenna itself will experience a phase shift. Make the antenna too long, it becomes inductive reactance, and it creates in itself a lagging phase. Make it a little bit too short, it creates a leading phase. So the antenna itself does experience a phase shift when you're off resonance. That's basically the theory of operation and how a Yagi works. It's how you make directors and reflectors. So correcting the elements to make them the right frequency, I recommend you do that. And that's not too difficult. Feed the antennas one at a time. Add clip leads to make them a little bit longer. The fact that they may be non-symmetrical, so the upper half is a little longer than the lower half, in my opinion, that's an extremely minor effect. The phase center is still going to be approximately the right altitude. And that's a fairly insensitive phenomenon. Resonance, though, is, I think, a somewhat sensitive phenomenon. So feed each one of the antennas one at a time and do tune them to the right frequency with the presence of all the others. Maybe the right way to do the test is every one of the others is either open-circuited or short-circuited while you test each one of them. Now, when it comes to the distance from the tower being wrong, the altitude being wrong, all of those shifts in phase center of your four elements are easily correctable. by adding and subtracting phase of the signal you feed to the elements, adding and subtracting length of cable that goes to those elements. The cross-coupling between the elements is going to change a little bit, and therefore the network you're probably going to buy to do all this phase shifting, to do the directional steering, won't be exactly right for your situation. That's not a super sensitive thing. It's not something you can thoroughly ignore, but it's not a showstopper. That's not a big sensitivity. Of all the things you've mentioned, I think resonant frequency is the biggest, and then positional shifts are sort of third after that. You're about to ask what is second. I don't think there is a second. And so you're going to get the darn much benefit out of just be using a phased array in the first place. I mean, you're jumping ahead 10 steps, and you're really going to backstep one or two because of imperfections. You're still going to get 9 steps of benefit, if you know what I mean. Once you start using a phased array, you'll never go back to anything else. There's got to be a pun there somewhere. N2 Moon Bounce, K2IW in the TechNet.
A comment there.
Okay, yeah. Mel, I bet you built some of these things. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, I didn't build anything like this. This is K2KEY, but I want to tell Barry, we were on the air about a week ago on 75 meters. We were on the air for 1 o'clock in the morning discussing this. And the Comtech system, there's a company called COMTEK System. I see them. I have their email here. And if you go to Comtech4@juno.com, they got everything. They're experts, they said, in the four square, and for 80 meters, they got the whole phasing and control systems and everything, or if you want information, they'll tell you the whole story from A to Z on four square, and what to expect and what to do, Barry, over.
You got it, Barry.
Okay, Mel, actually, I did call a guy. He's very friendly. I'm not so concerned. I know he knows a lot about phasing systems. I believe he's good at that. But as far as the antenna itself goes, I don't know. He said a few things to me that kind of confused me a little bit. And I'm going to actually ask Dick one of those questions right now. He said, if you're going to operate on 3795 or whatever you're going to operate on, tune the antennas to 3795, all four of them, and put them together. And yet I heard somebody else say, because these antennas are all in proximity to each other, you actually have to tune it to a frequency somewhat lower. What do you think?
I think the guy you talked to was right. If all four antennas are approximately the right distance from each other, and if that distance creates a shift of their resonant frequency, all in the same direction, they all go a little bit up or a little, you'll go a little bit down. That's okay. They're tracking each other, and you've got a phased array. The bad situation would be some of the antennas are tuned high, some of the antennas are tuned low. Therefore, even though you're feeding them right, some of them are creating a lagging phase angle, some of them are creating a leading phase angle. And now some of the benefit of a phased array will disappear. The main lobe, you won't lose much of it. The back lobe, side lobes, the rejections, you'll lose a lot of that. So front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, whatever it is you're supposed to get, you've got to have the right phases and the right positions of the phase centers of the antennas for that to work the way it was designed. Now, again, that's not a showstopper. With a little bit of testing, you'll eventually find this out. You're enough of a scientist, you'll talk to guys in each one of the compass headings, and you'll find out what's going on by flipping all the switches, and pretty soon, Mel, you and I will discuss it, and you'll come to the conclusion that, okay, mechanically I had to shift this particular antenna in electrical length and physical position, and therefore I created that much phase shift of that particular portion of the pattern, and all I've got to do is add or subtract a little bit of feed line to that particular cable that feeds that antenna, and I'm back in the ballpark. It's correctable, but you're going to have to work at it a little harder. It's not going to explode. Nothing bad's going to happen. Just you'll sacrifice some of the nulling performance. The peaking performance, you've got to do something really criminal before that goes away. But the nulling performance, and you probably will devalue that sometimes, that's kind of delicate. There are times when you're getting a huge amount of QRM for some particular direction, and you'd like to be able to null that direction. That's a somewhat critical item. And if you don't have it at first, you can tweak it and get it later. So very similar to what happens when a new ham gets his license. He opens up a catalog, and he sees 40,000 radios, and he gets on the air and says, which one should I buy? And he starts going down the list of, this one has this advantages, this one has that advantages, this one has this price, that one has that price, this one has this size, this one can be running portable. There's a zillion variables. And you can sit and study all those variables for a year, and you spend a year without a radio. You'd go to a flea market, buy some beat-up old thing that was thrown down a flight of stairs, but it's operational, and you buy it for some cheap price, and you're on the air, and you're talking to people while you decide what your dream rig should be. By the same token with you, don't let this thing stop you. Do the best you can, put it up, and I guarantee you've got the technology to tweak it. And you'll make it perfect if you want to put in the effort. N2MB, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Okay, well, actually, I have one of the vertical, they're not really vertical dipoles, they're vertical inverted Vs. I think you pretty much know what I'm talking about now after our last discussion. One of them is up, and I've had a chance just to merely compare it to a horizontal inverted V. I found something interesting already. Tonight was the first night I had a chance to listen to it. One is vertical, one is horizontal. The only difference right now, they're both fairly resonant. I haven't finished tuning the vertical one yet, but I will. I'm noticing, listening to stations in, say, Holland or Eastern Europe, which I was doing tonight, they almost always come in better on the vertical one. Stations in the United States almost always come in better on the horizontal one. Thought that was curious. It's not a big difference, but it is a difference. Also, I think probably Mel would agree with me. I started listening in the daytime. Of course, I wasn't hearing any DX. The vertical antenna was much worse than the horizontal in the daytime. At nighttime, vertical antenna started to sound almost as good as the horizontal one on these very same stations that were much weaker in the daytime, namely the ones like in Florida or something like that. Over.
Now, some of the horizontal versus vertical, stateside versus Europe and so on, a big factor there is Faraday rotation. And the amount of Faraday rotation you get between Europe and you, I'm not sure, but it might be 5 complete flips. And the number of flips you get, and whether you get a horizontal, vertical, a slant 45 right, or a slant 45 left, what you get is a function of what is the ionosphere like now, what's the compass heading that the signal is coming from, what's the state of the magnetic field. There's a bunch of variables. If you carefully monitor polarimetry, in other words, by looking at the horizontal signal, the vertical signal, simultaneously, and looking at the phase difference between the two and the amplitude difference between the two, you put that together in the right kind of a circuit that you can build, and you can even display it as a lizard view pattern on your oscilloscope, you will be doing polarimetry. You therefore can say, today, that signal from Holland, yeah, it's strong, it sounds louder on my vertical antenna, but its exact polarization today is 13 degrees clockwise from vertical. And yesterday it was 17 degrees clockwise from vertical. You have the ability to do that. That could be a lot of fun. Polarimetry, there's a lot more to it. And the average amateur has some trouble understanding phase shift, and the next level of understanding beyond that is looking at phase shift and amplitude differences, which is really a vector measurement, which then is a polarimetry measurement, and you can measure the essentially precise polarimetry you're getting at this hour of this day from that direction. That would be kind of fun. And depending on what you see and the way you accumulate those statistics of polarimetry, guarantee it'll give you some hints as to what the next rock crusher antenna you're going to build is. All of the really good radio telescopes are measuring polarimetry of the signals they get from those stars. It tells them a lot about what the local magnetic field is like 50 light years away. They just sit there and do a passive measurement of polarimetry, and by the Zeeman effect, they know what the local magnetic field is like. Kind of interesting to me. Thank you, Barry.
W2VL repeater system.
Okay, I thought you were on a timer. All right, real good, real good. Yeah, I am going to do that, actually. I do have plans to do that. That sounds like a fun thing to do. And it was in my plans, which I got to get a few more antennas up. I think by next week I'll be constructing the second antenna. What I'm going to do in the beginning, and I got to talk to this fellow who makes the phasing. I forget his calls. Mel just gave me his calls. I got to talk to him. If I could use the same phasing system, the same switching device, if I only have two antennas and not four to start out with, because obviously I'm going to have two before I have four. And this is probably just going to take quite a bit of time, because some of these antennas is going to be a real nightmare to get them out there. I've got to make spreader arms 45 feet long to hold it out there, and all kinds of weird stuff. But it's a fun project, and it's keeping me going. As they say, I got the first one up today, and I'm maintaining this one horizontal inverted V as a standard to see where we're going with this. And Mel, I really want to get together with you and that fellow down in Pennsylvania again to compare these again. This would be nice. So I'm going to turn it over to Mel real quick, and then we'll give it back to Dick, N2MB.
Okay, very good, Barry. Yeah, tomorrow night, same place, 3715 at 1130 at night. Be glad, in fact, I look forward to listening to the difference and see what comes up. And, of course, my friend George will be on frequency. And we have one or two other guys, maybe. This other guy up in Massachusetts may be joining us. He's running a full-wave loop. And possibly another guy with a vertical gets on with us. John up there in Fred, up there in Ontario. So if all of them are on frequency tomorrow, you surely can get a very definitive, you know, signal report. In fact, you can use, we're close enough that you can use me as, you know, as a comparison using the full wave loop, and what the difference will be with you using the one portion of the Foursquare. Too bad I can't find that article. I remember that article because it's even here. He mentions it in his advertisement. The article was in CQ Magazine, written by, maybe you can Google this, Barry. Look for K3LR, K3 Larry Radio, Long Radio, whatever you want to call him. He's the one that designed the system originally. And Comtech is the one that took it over manufacturing it, but it was in CQ Magazine, Barry. So maybe you can find it in CQ Magazine. Maybe it's in PDF form or something, if you look back, Barry, over.
Okay, I'm going to do that tonight. And I think you said 3715. I wasn't sure if it was 3750 or 3715, so correct me on that.
At the same place last week, 3715, over.
Okay, great. I don't want to have everybody wait while we're passing that information. Okay, let me turn it back over to Dick. I'm going to be in my car in a few minutes, so I'll rejoin you from the car. And this is going to be a good winter project, I think. This should keep us going for a while. And, it's what you do when you can't do much on microwave because you lost satellites and they don't have any. So I got to warn you guys, once they get another satellite up there, I'm going to cut this thing up into little pieces. Okay? That's my first love, N2MB.
And my first love is microwave. I've been off 10 gigs now for quite a few years. Bruce is slowly getting back on. I'm getting the itch. And if we get 10 gigs and 24 gigs back on Long Island, I mean, these guys up in New England and down in Pennsylvania, they hold these microwave contests 3 times per year. And all of a sudden, they're not getting FN30 Long Island. We've dug ourselves a hole, we jumped into the hole and pulled the hole in after us. Radio microwave-wise, we've temporarily died, or we're comatose. we're in a coma. We got to do something about that. So I've got this nice tower, I've got these nice antennas, I just got to put it all together. And if you were moving from house A to house B and you're selling your house and you got to take down your towers and all your antennas, and for 3 months you got nothing, you feel naked as a ham radio operator. And 10 gigs wise, that's where I feel. So there will be some microwave activity. Bruce is coming online with his last 2.5 towers on every single band from 6 meters to 10 gigs, all inclusive. He's got that 75% operational. I've got some great capability. You know what they say is a Chinese curse. Your children should have great potential. That's a fancy way to say it's going to be very frustrating, particularly if they don't realize all that potential. Okay, let's talk about some more fun stuff. Paul, what's happening in space? There's got to be some good news. I hope that we're going ahead with repairing the Hubble. I'm a Hubble hugger. That's the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. And Spirit and Opportunity come in as a close second and third, doing marvelous things. And the International Space Station is doing pretty well. It's getting bigger and heavier. And just think, all of that, whatever goes up must come down. All of that's coming back someday. But of course, that's a couple of lifetimes downrange. Right, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is WS2N and Spirit and Opportunity. They're doing great. They were supposed to last 30 days or so. They would have been happy. 3 months, they would have been thrilled. Here they are in 3 years on the 4th of January when Spirit landed. Opportunity is another week or so away on the 14th, and that'll be up to 3 Earth years. And, They're doing fantastic. They've gone through a couple of winters already on Mars, and they're really doing great. They never expected those two things to last as long as they did. The battery powers, the batteries that they're using, they keep recharging. They keep coming up to 80% usefulness after all these years. The winds that are on Mars, they never expected them to be as useful as they are. In fact, they thought maybe that would be a downfall with all the dust storms. Every now and then a wind goes by and cleans off those solar panels, and then they wind up with more power. And they sit on a hill for 3-4 months at a time during the winter with the solar panels facing toward the sun on a tilt. They'll park on a tilt. And they'll be able to do science during those months and take panoramic pictures. Not move, but when the winter's over, they're off and running. They're off and running again. So the Opportunity has a bad shoulder blade, you might call it. Has a problem with that, but still operational. Spirit has had a bad wheel for, I don't know, a year and a half or so. But they just keep dragging their right front wheel. Dragging it, you actually drive backwards, and they could drag it behind them, and that thing keeps on going. So the engineers did quite a good job on that thing. Now let's see, 2009, I think it is. Let's see, we're in 2007, so I think another year they're going to launch another mission to Mars called the Phoenix. That's going to land near the polar area, and that's not going to drive around. That's going to dig into the ground and look for organic material and actually ice. They want to dig up some ice, melt it, poke around. So the Phoenix mission, and then 2 years after that, they'll launch the Mars Laboratory. It's another big rover mission, bigger than much twice the size of the Spirit and Opportunity, and that should be a very interesting mission. I've heard that they're going to do one, possibly two of them at the same time. But Dick, I wanted to talk about before the holidays. I know the holidays got in the way a little bit with the net here. We talked about the ability of the International Space Station to transmit power from the solar panels to the International Space Station deck stuff. How am I coming through? I'll continue, right?
Absolutely, loud and clear. Now, you want the International Space Station with its huge solar panels to send power where? Paul, go ahead.
Okay, I remember discussing on the net, we were talking about how do they get the power from the panels to the space station themselves? You know, you've got, eventually you're going to have four panels, main panels on the port side, four panels on the starboard side, and each panel, actually, each section has two panels, so essentially it's really like eight complete panels. But you'll have a port side and a starboard side, and they have these gigantic rotating joints, which have the ability to rotate these 200-foot-long things every 90 minutes to compensate for the space station going around the Earth. It orbits every hour and a half, and these things have to turn every hour and a half to face the sun to get maximum view of the sun. Although, you know, roughly every 30 minutes out of those 90 minutes, they will be in the dark. So on board these solar trusses, they do have batteries to store the power as this is happening. The question we had that we had talked about is, do they bring this in DC, strictly DC, or do they convert it maybe to AC? And from my research now, according to one of the websites from Lockheed Martin out in California, now make, you know, they're the ones that make these, they call them a solar alpha rotary joint. The SARJ, and it's a big, heavy thing. You know, weighs a couple of tons, I guess. It's located between the one that's up there, the port side, the port three and port four truss that was brought up two missions ago on the space shuttle, and it's really two trusses in one. But in between this third and fourth truss, you know, they have truss 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all the way up to 6. It, you know, in between the 3 and 4 segments, they have this solar alpha rotary joint. And it says here that it's 10 feet in diameter and weighs, you know, a ton and a half, just the joint itself. It can spin 360 degrees. They do use bearing assemblies to do that, servo control to turn it, but all the power will flow through. They have a utility transfer assembly on board. You know, it's inside this this gigantic disc, you might call it. Now, it does say it has roll ring assemblies, to allow the transmission of data and power across the rotating interface. So it never has to, you know, unwind or twist. You know, this will always be continually moving. So, yeah, it's that again is by Lockheed, Dick. And then Boeing had an article in its website, and it talks about the same SARJ joint, 10.5 feet diameter. They talk about it being about a meter long, say 40 inches long. It says it will maintain the solar arrays in an optimal orientation to the sun while the entire space station orbits the Earth once every 90 minutes. They have drive motors in the SA RJ will move the arrays through the 360 degrees of motion at about 4 degrees per minute. The joints rotate the arrays smoothly without imparting vibrations to the laboratories or the habitation modules, you know, where they live in, like Destiny and the Russian module, and future modules that will be put on there. And that would definitely impact any kind of microgravity activities. You know, they want to keep their station with no vibrations, you know, especially for a lot of their experiments. And here's the important part for me anyway. At the same time, 60 kilowatts, now this is just on the port, you're going to have 60 kilowatts on the starboard side eventually. Another one of these joints is going to be going up on SDS-117 in March for the starboard side, but it says 60 kilowatts of power at 160 volts will be, you know, plus data channels will be carried across each joint by copper roll rings. So it sounds like everything's going to be DC from what I'm reading. And I did the quick math with, P equals E times I for power, and I come up with the 60 kilowatts and 160 volts. I came up with 375 amps. That's just on one side, and then, but that's what's got to be able to go through these monster joysticks. So I thought I'd give an update on that. And also on the Carl Sagan topic that the other fellow brought up. Very interesting topic. We always talk about him all night long, that guy. He's very good. But 300, over 300 amps. It's unbelievable. Back to you. WS2N.
I did the exact same calculation as you, 375 amps. And if I had to reliably conduct 375 amps through some kind of copper roll assembly, slip ring-like assembly, and rotate it once every 90 degrees continuously, every 90 minutes, 360 degrees of rotation, while 375 amps is flowing, my goodness, that does not sound like a reliable assembly. I don't care how big those pressures are. I don't care what materials the slip rings are made out of. I wouldn't trust it. You're making this fine dust in the slip rings with the brushes that's getting into the bearings. There may have been a roll copper assembly rings for communication, low-level signals. I can sort of see that. But the main power, I'm still voting for inductive AC power transfer through the rotary joint. When it's 10 feet in diameter and a couple of feet long, that's a massive bearing for a great big structure. I just got a gut feel that that power is magnetically or electronically coupled with an inverter. I know you're finding stronger and stronger evidence that it's DC coupled, and portions of it after the rectification and the filtering and regulation are going to be DC, 160 volts DC. I agree with that. But across that rotary joint itself, as you can tell, I'm having a lot of trouble with it. When I read some of the articles that come across my desk on the subject of the peculiarities that happen in a hard vacuum, that you just take two very optically flat pieces of metal and you bring them together in a hard vacuum, and they might weld themselves. Brushes are known to weld themselves to a commutator in a hard vacuum. So you can see I'm having a lot of trouble with it. Now, when it comes to spirit and opportunity, only having to work for 30 days to be considered successful, and here we've just passed the third year on the first landing and about to pass the third year on the second landing, you put that together with any of the PBS documentary programs. They show you about how spirit and opportunity and their parachute and whatever was designed. You watch the Wright Nova special on that. You rapidly get the impression that some significant percentage of that design is the blood, sweat, and tears for multiple years of Steve Squires of Cornell University. He put everything he had into that. I'm amazed he didn't end up with a divorce over that. I mean, that became his child, his wife, his children. It became everything, his reason for existence. He worried about all the details. You need a man on a project like that to champion that product, to really worry about whether or not that thing you're creating will live well and prosper for a couple of year period of time while he was designing that thing and redesigning it and fixing it and making it better and getting rid of the glitches. And the last most significant glitch they got rid of a couple of hours before re-entry into the Martian atmosphere. They did a major recommanding just to make sure that a particular critical switch wouldn't hang them up. They really worried about the details. That's what it is. Good engineering is in the details. You've got to be obsessive, compulsive. On that particular product, temporarily, he was insane. It's a good kind of insanity, but that's my take on it. Temporarily, he was insane. His whole reason for existence for a significant number of years was that piece of hardware. And you're seeing the results of it. And he can sit back now and almost enjoy it. But I got some guess as to what that kind of a personality is like. He's still worrying on a day-to-day, is it healthy? Does it have a cold? And is the dust going to be blown off of your solar cells? And can it keep dragging that wheel? Can it keep working with that broken shoulder? And so on. That's quite a success project. Quite a success. And I hope we may have more of them. Another beautiful piece of hardware. Okay. Mel, I know you want... There's a couple of things you probably would like to discuss. So, I think we ought to give you some time. Also, I think we've got to start some kind of ham radio education of our individual communities of the leaders. It's not that we're forcing the hams to be listened to as experts. Just they have to bring the fact that the decisions being made are so wrong, and many of these communities have some very intelligent people. All you got to do is point them in the right direction and give them enthusiasm and say, go, research this. Look on the internet, read a couple of books, convince yourself that it's not just a bunch of crazy hams that love electronics and love radio. That RF is your friend, it's not your enemy. You either join that friendship or you die. You die from criminally negligent homicide. That's what it really is. It's just a matter of time before somebody dies because the right radio equipment wasn't available. They either bled to death in their car after an accident or the car caught on fire. The emergency services, the first responders, were not there soon enough because the radio equipment didn't support that kind of an operation. It's just a matter of time before some family member dies in that manner and the rest of the family sues the town for criminally negligent homicide. You read those reports by those experts these towns are bringing in, and you read the inadequacy of the emergency communication and the lack of interoperability that is there now. And the Homeland Security has offered multiple millions of dollars to correct it. And these foolish people, misunderstanding the problem, are saying, no, not in my backyard. In a case of criminally negligent homicide, when such a case comes before a court of law, the first thing the judge and the jury wants to know is, what did you know, and when did you know it? By way of those expert reports that they paid for and now exist, and you read it, that's when you know for sure. The knowledge is there. It's not how many of these towers and water towers and whatever we remove our antennas to from. That's what they're deciding right now. The right answer is, how many more do you add? Not which towers have antennas. Why not all of them and then some? Towns have to be brought into the 21st century. It's nice to say, I want to live a nice, simple, agrarian life. You have that option in the United States. You can go live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, if you want to, with the Amish and with the Mennonites, and you can live a very nice, simple life if you want to. The majority of people want the benefits of modern society. Radio is one of those, wireless products is one of those huge benefits. Education is required. I think we amateurs are charged with a huge responsibility to correct a terrible problem of what I'm calling criminally negligent homicide. It's a little bit strong, but there's a degree of truth to it. I guess I've made my point. I'm hot under the collar. Mel, does this bother you as much as it bothers me? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2AAU, a comment.
Quick comment about the Mars rovers.
Okay, the first place that has a quick comment, not Mars rovers, identify yourself and go ahead and make the comment. And correct, I'm probably legally way off base. Go ahead.
K2AAU, a comment. Dick, there's one thing you didn't touch upon there, and that's the fact that the radio vendors misleading the public and telling them that their program or their communications is the best for them, and doing things the old-fashioned way, well, that's the old-fashioned way. It doesn't work anymore. Motorola being one of those vendors.
There's a little bit of that, Mr. AAU. However, the expert report that was paid for was not by Motorola. It was outside independent agency that assessed the degree of inadequacy of that communication system. Yes, there's a little bit of profiteering going on, without a doubt. And so the buyer beware. You're absolutely right on that one. But that's not the majority of the problem. There's a much huger problem here. The xenophobia in the minds of those well-meaning parents of those children in those schools that are near the water tower that has the radio tower antenna on it. I did a little bit of a calculation. What is really required for the thing that they're worrying about to come about? Could a child really be in trouble? And here's the scenario that can just barely get that child in trouble. The child has to leave the schoolyard, run across the street, climb over the fence, get into the yard where the water tower is, climb up the legs of the water tower, get up to the first level where you got that deck, climb over the ladder where you go over on top of the tank of the water tower itself, crawl across the tank, go over to the middle of the tank, kneel down in front of the antenna, 5 feet from the antenna, and stare into the antenna for 5 solid minutes. Then the fireman or the policeman with that particular transmitter, which normally is on the air for 10 seconds at a time, for him to give a very brief message, he has to key the mic of the transmitter, wrap a rubber band around the push-to-talk switch, and leave it running, key down, for 6 solid minutes, while the child, kneeling in front of the antenna, on top of the tank, 5 feet away from the antenna, stares in the antenna with his eyes open. You do that, you're at the threshold of alarm of the American standard. Is that realistic? Is that what we're worried about? That's what it takes to get them in trouble. We've been heating our food with microwave ovens for 20 years. So we can heat our food, and you take 1 millionth that amount of power and expose it to people, and you think you're going to cook the people? Come on. Craziness. K2AAU, I should know your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
All right, Dick, Artie, K2AAU, Alpha Romeo, Tango, India Echo. I've been listening to you for the past hour or two. You make perfect sense. But you're right about one thing. Mainstream, we lack the time and energy to get out there and educate the public. There should be some kind of medium that could be used in order to educate the public. I don't know what would be a good one. Maybe something in a local paper. Who knows? But education is lacking, and unfortunately because of that, people are only going by assumptions that other people are making, and unfortunately, that's what's hurting us. All right, I'll let you throw it back to the station. I'm going to take a listen. You have a very interesting Q-show that you're having with everybody. Enjoying it immensely. So back over to you, Dick. This is K2AAU.
Yeah, I'm going to add one more comment to this, Artie. Approximately 40,000 people per year in the United States die because of vehicular accidents. Used mostly automobiles, a little bit two-wheel vehicles. 40,000 people a year die.